for that
illuminating slide.
And the segue into Bob James's presentation. Once again, you've got Bob's CV before you, or short bio. And once again, we have somebody with a long and detailed experience in this sector. I had met Bob in the days when we were doing certain things back in Telstra. He was off talking to a certain company in Seattle and organising a few deals for us, which one of which was on Australia. And Bob reminded me yesterday that in those days, what he was doing on behalf of Telstra was buying IP backbone networks from Arnet for Telstra to sell a retail internet service. So it was a bit of a slightly different world in those days. Bob is going to talk to us about exactly what Benoit has finished on, fixed broadband and a utility model. So could you please welcome Bob.
Thank you, David. Benoit's asked some great questions, and I really do like the cartoon at the end. I recently bought a beach house about 150 kilometres out of Melbourne, and I have great electricity at the beach house, but I can't get DSL. So I wish that the communications utility was as good as the power utility. I do want to talk a bit about whether communications is a utility, and the answer isn't one thing or the other, but I think there's a lot to be learnt from utilities in terms of the deployment of broadband networks. And in particular, I'm talking about fixed broadband, and I'm talking about fixed broadband in the context that governments around the region, in particular Singapore, New Zealand and Australia, are all paying a great deal of attention to achieving social goals. And I've articulated what I think to be the summary of the goal, which is nationwide, affordable, real broadband with a high level of adoption. And in fact, I've taken a liberty in adding two emphases. One is that it be real broadband, and I'll talk later about what do I mean by real broadband. And it's more than speed, of course. And secondly, I think the high level of adoption is incredibly important. And Benoit's figures were also heading towards that. We want most houses in the street and most streets in the country to be connected, and we also want most houses to actually use the service. So it's not availability, it's actually adoption that has significant impacts on the business case for the operator, as well as significant impacts on social goals. So who are the stakeholders? And I think it's really important to, I guess we've been through this in one way or another a few times, but it's quite important to look at what different people are asking for today. And in the case of governments, it's by and large the slow rate of deployment and after deployment the slow rate of take-up. Consumers, very interestingly, want faster services, but there is very little willingness to pay. And I've heard a number of people say that in the last 2 days. But it's quite critical. How do we get national broadband used by more people in a context where more people don't want to pay? Thirdly, we have application and content providers afraid of having new charges imposed on them. We have access competitors who want to be in the game of selling communications but can't afford to build second or third networks in many cases. And we have incumbent network operators in many situations who are seeing a decline in the return on their investment from their current networks rather than a growth, and are afraid that whatever changes may come will in fact further drive down the return on investment. And largely, we have regulators who mostly around the world would prefer to have infrastructure competition. But infrastructure competition is quite limited in erupting around the world. In fact, it's sort of a slow crawl rather than an eruption, and it tends to crawl over a certain area of ground, but then stop. And I think it may well be that services competition is a better goal than infrastructure competition. And the question is, returning back to that national goal for broadband infrastructure, can the goal be met and the stakeholders' concerns be satisfied? And I think the answer is they can be, and in fact I'll be trying to lay out for you an outline of what it might look like in New Zealand. I'll be using Australian figures, but the model's pretty directly applicable here. And I think it's the kind of approach that could in fact make New Zealand a world leader. In fact, I'll skip a few of these slides in order to move forward quickly. What I am going to talk about today is a different definition of broadband. I'll touch briefly on the question of whether fixed and broadband are competitors or not. Then I'm going to briefly go through the IT industry's experience of moving to IP and the lessons that can be learnt, many of which I think can be directly applied to fixed broadband. and then in fact suggest what I think the next few steps for fixed broadband are, and from that look at the business implications, and finally suggest a way forward. So what do I mean by real broadband? Well, the first thing that gets a lot of attention is the speed, and I've shown a graph here from Optus in Australia where Maha has pointed out that typically the headline speeds are 4 or 5 times higher than the average speeds. And so there are many people, including me, who think that it would be better if we in fact advertised the achievable and deliverable speeds rather than some headline. But speed is by no means the primary definition of value in broadband. In fact, if you ask people, you know, how much broadband did you use last month, they won't say I used 100 megabits a second. They'll say, you know, I used 3 gigabytes or 20 gigabytes, I'm on a such and such plan. But it's the gigabytes that tend to be the thing that's defined by most people as being the best indicator of their use. And in fact, in Australia, the average usage is 3 gigabytes a month. That means about 10 kilobits per second on average delivery. And were people to have 12 megabit per second connections to their home and use it for 24 hours a day, it'd be 4,000 gigabytes a month. And of course, no one uses that. So the point is, on average around Australia and in fact around the world, most people don't use anything like the potential capacity of broadband networks. And we could in fact design networks today that deliver the capacity that people want, so that when you try to watch the movie, make the VoIP call, or do whatever else it is you want to do, the networks can support it. But the critical thing is you actually have to have a pay for use to do that. And I'll be describing later a pricing model that I think makes it viable to deliver people broadband that actually does do what you'd expect it to do. And the last thing is application independence. With electricity, Mr. Potato Head would expect to be able to plug in his iPod, his TV, or his cordless telephone to the same electricity socket and have it work. Same deal for broadband. I expect to be able to plug in any appliance and use it. So being able to support any application and have the capacity and deliver a reasonable speed is my definition of real broadband. Very briefly on fixed and mobile, I think fixed and mobile are complementary. I have two broadband phones sitting on the table there that I carry with me, and I'm connected with broadband data, but when I'm at home, I also want broadband at home, and even when I'm not at home, I want my home connected to broadband. So for people who are, have left their the family home and have children of their own, they probably want fixed broadband and mobile broadband. So for me, they're primarily complementary. There is a danger, though, and it's a danger I might touch on a bit more later, which is that mobile broadband is getting better all the time, and the business case for fixed broadband is arguably getting worse all the time. And if that's true, there's a window of opportunity in which broadband networks can be deployed, and if we wait too long, it may not make sense to deploy fixed broadband. So I might come back to that later. What do I think is the really big change with broadband? I think it's not the increase in speed, but the shift from being vertically integrated to horizontally integrated. So the diagram here shows the world of IT in the middle, the network worlds of telephony and pay TV, the mobile world, all vertically integrated prior to IP. And around 95 onwards, the world started delayering, and in the IT world, it was all over by about 1995. Companies like Wang with WangNet and IBM with SNA moved on to IP, and their business models changed as they moved to an open and layered structure. With communications, of course, we're seeing the same things happening in the fixed world and with LTE in the mobile world. And the implications are quite profound, some of which I'll go into in a moment. In the IT world, the thing that I think really strikes people, or strikes me at least, is that up until 95 it was clear that the IT world was going with IP. There was a lot of discussion about ISDN and broadband ISDN up until 95, and not long thereafter people stopped talking about broadband ISDN as being the mainstream infrastructure, and the whole world went to IP. So my view is we can actually predict pretty well what's going to happen in the communications world for the next 10 years by looking at what happened in the IT world. So here's my proposal. Up until the 1990s, in fact up until about 95, we had copper networks for telephony and coax networks for pay TV. Somewhat to many people's surprise, we managed to shoehorn broadband into these application networks. And you know, for those of us who've been around long enough, it was regarded as a minor miracle that you could in fact put broadband down a telephone pipe. You know, we used to think it was the 3 kilohertz cable, and we were just stunned that you could in fact get megabits per second down it. In the case of the pay TV networks, it was also a bit of a surprise there, but we did. And the surprising thing though was that broadband was carried by an application network. We're now on the edge of the first generation of broadband, and I'm thinking here of the sort of deployment that Verizon has, where you've got a single network terminating unit and it's got 4 or 5 ports on it. Every port has potentially a separate price. You might buy them as a bundle, and in the case of Verizon, you can only buy them from Verizon. In an open access world, you might be able to buy them from different people. But it's basically 5 ports with 5 price points. It gets really interesting, though, when you get to the end game. And the end game looks just like the blue cables that we all have in our offices. There's one pipe, you know, think about 100 megs a second, think symmetrical, the sort of thing that NTT has done in Japan and TASCOT did in Tasmania. But 100 megs a second, symmetrical, one port, and plug in your telephone, your TV, or your personal computer. All plug into the same port, and there's just literally one port. And to the extent that the operator can separate out a voice over IP service and charge for it separately, they do, for example, NTT. But equally, the customer could just take a single port at a single price point. So my allegation is this is the obvious and natural evolution path for broadband. And I guess the only alternative would be if somebody said, well, I really want 4 or 5 different pipes into my house and I want them to be unique and special, where one's for TV, another one's for telephony, and another one's for something else. But I think it's the very definition of broadband that any application can be delivered. So what about the business model and the regulatory frameworks that go with this evolution? In the early days, up until 92, it was really easy. It was all about telephone calls. It was pre-selection, it was cost per call minute, it was interconnection. Nobody spoke about things like network neutrality and open access. Move forward to the mid-90s and on to today, and access has been the big issue, and unbundling has been the sort of thing that the regulatory focus has been on. As you move to the next generation, sort of the Verizon-style modem, it's about open access. Can I access one of those ports on the modem, or do I have to buy all of them? And can I buy it wholesale, or is it only reserved for the network owner? And then in the last generation, I'm saying, similar deal, except there's only one port, so it can only be sold by one wholesaler and then sold by another retailer. And network neutrality becomes the issue that concerns most people. Will any application be available through that port? So that's the general business model. But look down at the revenue drivers and the network funding. Traditionally, the network was funded by telephony, and telephony grew for about 100 years in most countries. Call volumes grew, prices fell, but revenues in total grew. Around about 2000, it started changing. Most analyses of fixed network operators from 2000 on are saying pretty flat, maybe in decline. And for some operators who've lost as much as 30% of their fixed telephony, possibly seriously in decline. When you take the next step to the pipe of pipes, the telephone calls are now separated away if it's being provided under open access. So the network owner has potentially 5 ports to sell with 5 price points, but that's the revenue. And in France, I was doing a bit of work there a few years ago, and you could, for €1 a day, you could get 20 megs of internet connection, 20 channels of pay TV, and unlimited second line calling. So €1 a day per house. And if you knew how many days there were in the year and how many houses there were in France, you could work out the revenue of the telephone company forever. It's not a model which leads inherently to a lot of growth. So who's benefiting from the network investment? My suggestion is we're seeing very clear benefits to the community. I can do all manner of interesting and exciting things over the network with all manner of businesses, and I and the people I deal with are all more efficient. So great news for the community. Good news for people like Google, eBay, and any other large network business. They also are getting to develop great businesses in great marketplaces. And down the bottom, end users are getting more typically and paying less. So they're doing very nicely. But again, when you look at the bottom line of the network operator doesn't necessarily have a growing business case. You know, looking at the history of the last 5 years and the migration to broadband, and looking at the potential future revenues, it's not clear to me that it's a great business case. And if we want to make it better, well, who can pay? And the answer is there's really essentially only three options. One is the government pays more. And interestingly, around the region, we're seeing governments choosing to put money into networks and looking for to achieve certain social goals as they put the money in. Second option is have the B party pay more, possibly voluntarily. For example, a 1-800 style service where when I connect to a certain video on demand service, the end user isn't charged for the data traffic, but the deliverer of the movie is. And lastly, a choice for the users. Should we ask the users to pay more, or can we have more users pay? And Benoit's figures about the penetration, the number of people who are using the service, I'll show you some of my figures later, which suggests it's really important to have the maximum number of people using the network. So, a few lessons about people who've tried building broadband networks. And I've used, you'll find many, many analyses of broadband. In fact, it's staggering how many analyses of broadband there are in the world. I think they outweigh the number of broadband networks significantly. The one that I found quite interesting was one by Raoul Katz from Citi. And his analysis, looking at a number of deployments around the world, was that NTT and Verizon are not making money. Now, they may have a business case for investing, but they're not necessarily making an incremental return on their investment. And that's the interesting question. You know, is there actually a new business case for investment rather than a defensive business case? And for reasons of time, I'll skim over the detail, but having done modelling of broadband networks in urban areas of Australia, as indeed have many other Australians in the last 6 months, it's very hard to model two new broadband networks feeding quarter-acre blocks and growing the revenues, especially if you take into account the reluctance of the consumers to pay more. So my view is that if you do the modelling, two new networks is hard to make work. There have been quite a few approaches tried in the past, and again I'll skim over the details. Vertical integration is one. You really need a pay TV player to be in existence previously. And if you don't have a good, strong, vertically integrated pay TV player covering most of your population, it doesn't apply. Telephony grab was tried in Australia, and with the Optus versus Telstra. And lastly, there are people who believe that wonderful new services will emerge which will pay for the network. And I've heard that maybe five times in the last 2 days. The problem with that model is, in an open access model, the network owner doesn't keep the revenues from the wonderful new services. Somebody else does. So it doesn't contribute to the business case, it just contributes to the number of access lines or the traffic through those lines. And a pretty simple model for access networks in a world in which applications separate from access is have the access networks pay for themselves. Traditionally, almost all networks have had cross-subsidies, but an innovative new model would be have access networks pay for access. How do we go forward? Here are the factors that reduce end-user pricing, and John DeRitter, who's in the audience, did these numbers. And what we've looked at is, in Australia, the $4.7 billion of Commonwealth funding will reduce the pricing by about $10 a month. If we can increase adoption by about 10%, we get a consumer benefit of about $8, so quite significant. And if it's 20%, maybe twice that amount. If the retail margins are reduced by 10%, that contributes only $4. If the network owner were to halve their return on equity from 20% to 10%, it's worth about $4. And if you have significant duplication of networks, so you're building two networks but getting the revenues from one, it works out as quite a significant cost to those people who are on either of the two networks. And competition may have its benefits, but it also has its costs. And I guess the quick summary of this is the top three things you might want to do are avoid duplication, leverage the government contributions, and make sure you increase adoption. I'm going to move quite quickly through a few more of these slides. The top diagram is all of the ADSL2 services in Australia, and it's a best fit line through all of the price points currently in the market, and it happens to work out at $50 plus $1 per gigabyte. If you try to set up a wholesale access price for an access service that would underpin those, if you try and put in any one fixed price, it doesn't work. If it's low, like $20 a month, it'll kill the network investment case, And if it's high, like $60 a month, it'll kill the retail pricing. So there's no one price ULL style that works for broadband. Two more pricing options. One was proposed by Fennec, and that was basically the faster the connection, the more you pay. My suggestion is it's much better to give everybody the fastest possible connection and allow them to use the maximum possible capacity. And if you do that, the bottom line model works pretty well. In the bottom model, customers are using an unconstricted price, but they're being asked to pay by the gigabyte. And if you were to use the line in the red line in the diagram, ballpark of a dollar a gigabyte is the sort of figure that is required. And the suggestion from myself and from John DeRitter, who's done the modelling behind this, is this actually works pretty well. It's a way of charging for wholesale access, and so remember, I'm not talking about backhaul, I'm not talking about international connectivity, just access, but it actually does work pretty well. Now, question of, is fixed broadband a utility? If you look at fibre to the home, and fibre to the node is not that much different, or fibre to the cabinet, the architectures are similar, the civil works costs are very similar, the economics are remarkably similar, and the separation of applications from infrastructure are remarkably similar. And if you want them to be affordable, you do much the same things, which I've listed down the bottom. And the bottom line is, I think there is actually quite a lot to say for using a utility model for broadband. Moving very quickly, we've also calculated the cost of delay in Australia. If you believe there is a 1% improvement in GDP from providing broadband, then we're looking at a ballpark of $750 million Australian dollars of benefit. If you delay it by 3 years, though, you lose a couple of hundred million dollars of benefit, ballpark of $5.7 billion a month. And the bottom line with this slide is, if you actually believe there's a national productivity gain to be had, then moving quickly is a good idea. And this slide is just saying, and again I'll go quite quickly, that if you look at if you analyse the cost difference between a network operator having 20% return on equity and 10%, it's about $5 to $10 billion of revenue, depending on how much equity the network operator has in place. And our conclusion is, given that there's about $200 billion of national benefit at stake, it's worth about 2 months of argument to settle out what the appropriate return on equity is for the network owner. It's not the biggest cost driver of the business case, though from the amount of discussion it generates, you would think it was. And so, heading very quickly towards to the end, this is my sort of summary of network utilisation utility style. And I think in the case of all of the utilities, they work really well because they have very simple products. They all have unconstricted downloads, except for the case of wastewater, which is an unconstricted upload. And they all benefit from very simple pricing models, you know, typically an affordable fee per month plus a usage fee. And in fact, if you look at the sort of pricing that I've been suggesting for broadband, you can get broadband pricing down to the same sort of price as water or wastewater. And the headline news is, if you can afford water or wastewater, you can afford broadband. So, my 5 steps to achieving national broadband access. First one is, make it affordable. It's really critical, the users don't want to pay more, and if the government thinks it's a really good thing to have more people using the service, affordability has to be an absolute priority, and you need to look at all of the things that drive affordability. And my earlier slides listed out what the factors are and how much they're worth, and you can pick and choose from the shopping list of factors and get the end user retail pricing. Second one is usefulness. People have water, gas, electricity and sewerage because it's useful. You know, basically they are services that everybody wants because they can use them for all sorts of important things, and the same I think applies to broadband. An unconstricted pipe that can access any kind of service is a great service. Third point is service providers and application providers. I am assuming an open access model, and I am assuming that will drive the utilisation of the network, but they want certain characteristics of provision of service. My fourth point is the network owners need a business case for change. I've heard many people argue about what the appropriate return on investment is, but the issue for the network owner is, if they're making a good return on investment today and somebody's proposing to move to something different, they're not likely to love it and embrace it if it's fundamentally a worse return. So I personally think it's not a bad thing to consider whether you need to get that change in return on investment from the network owner in order to move forward. And lastly, you do need to establish an appropriate industry context for fixed broadband, and I suspect it looks more like regulation as a natural pipe monopoly than anything else. That doesn't mean